And so when someone can present a topic to me that otherwise I wouldn't have known about and suddenly ferociously make me care about it, that's when I feel like I'm in the presence of fearless curiosity, because it's infectious.
You're listening to Choose to be Curious, a show all about curiosity. We talk about research and theory, but mostly it's conversations about how curiosity shows up in work and life. I'm your host, Lynn Borton. Welcome. Come, choose to be curious with us. Think for a moment of all the stories that try to warn us off curiosity. They go way back. Eve, Pandora, Icarus, that poor, long-suffering cat. We're steeped in stories that paint the perils of curiosity, not only to ourselves, but to everyone around us. We have historically tended to think of curiosity as high stakes, deviant behavior that messes with accepted norms and authority, which, of course, is exactly what it does. Now, think of tales that celebrate curiosity. Certainly, there are many more stories in the media that do these days research on the brain science underlying our investigative behaviors, better understanding of intrinsic rewards, the potent magic of situational power and personal humility in the workplace. And what of the iconic, heroic, curious people, real or imagined? Who comes to mind for you? If you've got a figure or two in mind from the past century or so, chances are pretty good a literary agent was involved. Someone who first heard the idea of that book and thought, yeah, the world needs to know that story, and I want to be its champion. A few months ago, I got a text message from a friend. I'm at a writing conference, she typed, listening to a panel of agents answer the question, what are you looking for? Kayla's answer began, I'm looking for fearless curiosity. Now, one of the many delights in creating a show like Choose to be Curious is that family, friends, and audience members alike have become amazing curiosity detectors for me. They spot news stories, elegant turns of phrase, or even the mildest expression of curiosity interest, and make sure to put it on my radar. So, such a text wasn't necessarily all that unusual in the general scheme of things, but the sender was a generously gifted writer, Laura McBride, who happens to have been a guest on Choose to be Curious, and is someone with a finely tuned curiosity antenna herself. You can find my conversation with Laura on my website. It's lovely. She's lovely. And with that text message, she happened to tap into a vein of curiosity conversation I've been feeling my way around for some time, the intellectual gatekeepers, if you will, the people who make it their business to shape what's in the public's mind, what informs our thinking, maybe our behavior. Teachers, obviously, journalists, of course, writers. But take it further upstream. Who helps the rest of us even have an opportunity to hear from those writers and their many different perspectives, to learn new ways of seeing or confront uncomfortable truths? Well, literary agents, for one. So when Laura said she had a bead on a literary agent specifically looking for curiosity, fearless, no less, I pounced. Kayla Leitner is a writer and literary agent at Aisha Pandey Literary. As an agent, she typically represents adult titles, though there are a select few middle grade titles on her list. She enjoys upmarket fiction, literary fiction, and nonfiction that straddles the line between storytelling and teaching readers something new. I'm thinking she's my kind of agent, and I am delighted to have Kayla Leitner join me today. So welcome, Kayla.
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for having me. That was a fabulous introduction. I got chills. I was like, oh.
I'm really excited about this conversation. I was excited the moment Laura texted me. First, a little primer. Mm-hmm. What does a literary agent actually do? Just a quick instruction for us.
One of the great things about this job is that agents all work in different ways that are unique to them. But I think at its core, if you distill it down, that creative and business partner with a writer is what we do. And so that looks like editing their manuscripts, preparing them for submission to publishers. And so there's a lot of matchmaking that occurs, right? Where I see a manuscript, I read it, I love it. And that's just the first step in what will be a very long journey for the work. The next thing I have to think is, okay, I love this. Who else do I know? What editors at which specific imprints and publishers will love this as well, right? And so then I send it to them, and hopefully we get someone who sees what I see, who's enthusiastic as I am about the work, has a clear idea for how to introduce this book to readers. And then we're off to the races. Also just kind of thinking long term. And it's actually the part of the job, or one of the many parts of the job, that I find really exciting is hopefully there's another book after the first one, right? And so not only are you focused on selling the author's initial work, but you also want to help them kind of strategize the rest of their career, right? What do they want to do? Mm-hmm. What stories do they want to tell? What audiences do they want to speak to? And getting to map that out with them is really exciting.
You know, I always like to know what makes people most come alive in the work that they do. And you said there are a lot of things that you really love about it, but what would you say about that?
Yeah, I love that question. I don't think I've ever been asked that. What makes me most come alive with my job? A couple of things. I think first and foremost, it's hard to put into words, quite frankly. It's just this very visceral feeling. I'm sure other people have used this metaphor on this show, but it's almost like an electric shock when you open your queries, which is the inbox where authors who are soliciting representation, they send you their manuscripts and hope that, you know, you'll read it and love it and reach out to them about representation. So when I'm combing through my queries and I come across the first 5 pages of a work, and I am sucked in immediately, right? Where I literally stop what I'm doing. All of a sudden, it's like this vacuum. And knowing from a very finite point, I'm in on this book. Like, that is truly one of the best feelings. And it's actually a very singular feeling. It doesn't happen often, surprisingly. There are books that you read that you're like, oh, I really love this. Or, oh yeah, I could totally see who would publish this. But that feeling of, oh, this is something really special. Wow. I can remember, and I'm being very literal with this, I think I can remember exactly where I was every moment that's happened for me with the book, just because it stands out so much. So I think that makes me come alive. And then also, more practically, being able to be what kind of the first person in the theater a little bit, right? Oh, yeah, before the show was about to start, before the curtains come up, you know, getting to be in the front row. Not that authors need my affirmation or anybody's affirmation, really, but getting to say, I see this thing that you have created. I love it. I think other people will love it too. And getting to be one of the first people to tell them that, just because writing is such a solitary endeavor, right? A lot of it is you just sitting in your, you know, office or in your, you know, living room or in your car, right? Wherever people get their writing done. And so finally being able to kind of be one of the first cheerleaders for them, that's a really great feeling as well.
This is really kind of peak experiences.
Yeah.
So how do you know when you're in the presence of fearless curiosity?
I think one of the coolest aspects of my job is getting to piggyback off like the expertise of other people, getting a kind of direct through line to the things that they're most passionate about. And so when someone can present a topic to me that otherwise I wouldn't have known about and suddenly ferociously make me care about it, that's when I feel like I'm in the presence of fearless curiosity, because it's infectious, right? Where someone was so, you know, taken with this subject that they sat down for multiple hours, for multiple days, for multiple months, usually for multiple years, to write a whole book about it. And now they're coming to me with it, and I'm excited to read it and learn more. And so, for example, I have one lovely author that I work with named Mary Kay McBrayer, who I first met, I want to say in 2018. I was still a wee assistant at that point. I had no titles that I was representing yet. But she was working on a book about a Black female gangster named Madame Stephanie St. Clair, who in Harlem during the Depression era, she ran a numbers racket. People played into, and yes, there was the gambling component, but she also used her winnings to keep the community afloat during the Great Depression. And so she was part criminal, because it wasn't legal, but also this kind of neighborhood folk hero. She'd been going through microfiche and library records trying to find the story of this woman, and decided that she had to be the one to write it. And we finally sold that book last year. And I could literally talk about Madame Stephanie St. Clair now for hours. She's such a cool lady. And so that is like a microcosm, I think, of what fearless curiosity means to me.
What I find really interesting about that is that that's a kind of communal mm-hmm. idea of fearless curiosity. It's not just the writer's curiosity that you're responding to, but your own curiosity and your expectation about what other people's curiosity yeah. will be. And as I was thinking about this, and I thought, well, what if someone was fearfully curious? Mm. Would that be different? What would that look like? I mean, would you sense that, intuit that, receive that differently?
It's funny because I think they are two sides of the same coin, being mm-hmm. fearlessly curious and fearfully curious. And I say that, maybe I'm telling on myself, as like a very still in some ways fearful person and someone who grew up very timid and tentative and always thinking about the worst possible outcome. And it's something that I'm still working on today. We've gotten better with age. But the fact that the fearful, if anything, it's you were curious about something, you felt that trepidation, you felt that fear, and you did it anyway. I think there's something equally amazing about that, right? And so if we want to put it in book terms or in contextualize it in the work that I do, I feel that a lot of the memoir or memoirists that I work with might fall under that vein instead. And so if we have our journalists and our historians who are fearlessly curious of, oh, I'm going to, you know, dash into the basement of some dank library and figure out who this person is or what this time period was. On the other side, we have a fearfully curious folks who sit down and say, you know, I have this own personal history or this familial relationship or internal hang up, whatever it may be. And I'm going to try and excise it on the page. I'm going to try to make sense of it for myself and also hope that other people can relate to it as well. And I can certainly confirm that a lot of the authors that I work or memoirists specifically that I work with, that fear is there. Before we started recording, we mentioned Annabelle Tomatich, whose memoir, The Mango Tree, is coming out. And every time I check in with her, I'm like, how are you doing? The first word she uses is terrified. That encompasses so much, right? And so anxious, obviously, but also really proud and excited and invigorated that the story that she's been sitting with for so long is finally going to be out in the world, right?
And brave.
Yeah, brave. Exactly.
I mean, if you do something and you're not afraid, then you're just doing it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
If you do something even when you are afraid, mm-hmm. that's brave.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
as you, I mean, to your point,
personal writing,
self-disclosure mm-hmm. within possible within writing, it's like the highest form of bravery in my mind, because then it's on the page for all the world to see.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's an interesting thing to think about your role as kind of a gatekeeper, right? Because that's got a potential negative connotation, right?
Absolutely.
You know, maybe it's better to think of it as an ambassador, but one of the reasons I was interested in you for this conversation and your agency, which I came to know through getting to know you, was that you're trying to change the history of gatekeeping within the print storytelling
world. Industry, yeah.
Yeah, take a moment and just sort of sink into that, if you would.
Yeah. Where to even begin with that?
I know.
I think you gain a very specific understanding and appreciation for how interconnected the folks who work in the publishing industry, of which there are many, the publishing industry is large, and there's so many other people working outside of agents and editors who are the two main roles that come to mind when people think of publishing. And there are so many other people who put in tireless work to make a single book come into fruition, right? But you gain a very specific understanding and appreciation for the correlation between who works in the publishing industry and who holds positions of power in the publishing industry, mm-hmm. and the ramifications that has on what books get published. And by extension, what readers feel seen, what readers see their experiences reflected on the page, right? It's all interconnected. And I'm certainly not coming on the show with a you know, very succinct, you know, solution for any of
that.
Yeah, or someone else would have figured it out by now, right? But just seeing how all of those threads come together. In a lot of ways, it starts with agents, right? When we are taking on a client, we are essentially saying, I can visualize. Actually, no, let me walk that back, because I think there are two different things. There are two different things that we're thinking about. One, obviously, I love this story. I'm excited about this. But also practically, can I sell this, right? Do I know a publisher who would be excited about it? And it is not always a one-to-one of, I love this story, I think it deserves to be told, and I know a publisher who will be excited about it. And that's not, I think that's far more publishing's problem than the writer's problem. And so with APL, this idea of, yes, I love that you pointed out it's gatekeeper, it's ambassador, but more specifically, pushing publishing, hopefully incrementally, bit by bit, to broaden its kind of understanding and acceptance of what stories deserve to be told, right? And it's not going to be the number one New York Times bestsellers that practically print money every year. Those already have their audience and they're great, right? But these stories that either are too niche or the experiences is too insular and we don't know if readers are going to be receptive to it, not to kind of hit the nail on the head, people are inherently curious. And so I think with each of the titles that we acquire and represent at APL, both myself and my colleagues, we are one thinking of, first and foremost, is this a good story? You know, is this book, whether fiction or nonfiction, saying something? But we're also thinking, you know, who is this book for, right? Who is going to feel seen in these pages? And that's what we keep returning back to in terms of the titles that we represent, wanting more and more people to feel seen.
Yeah. So given all that, what's the scariest power that you have?
Ooh, the scariest power that I have? I don't think of myself as a particularly scary person. So I'm like, none, but I guess it's like,
you don't actually have to be a scary person to have scary power,
that's
right?
That's true. A scary power, I guess. You could say, and I'm going to say this with a caveat, because this is actually something that writers often ask me when I'm at conferences, when I'm at panels, right? The power of saying no, right? And so as an agent, not everything is going to be for you. And there's going to be great stuff, make that clear, that's not for you. I can't tell you the number of times I've read something and I'm like, oh, someone is going to sell this. Like, someone is this. I'm for sure going to see this book in a Barnes & Noble or an indie bookstore in 2-3 years. I just won't be the agent representing it. So it's a no from me. And for writers, understandably, that can be very bewildering, right? But it's because there's so many other factors that come into play when it comes to author-agent relationship outside of the quality of the book, right? You know, our personalities, does it feel like we would work well together? That has been a very steep learning curve, is as equally important as the quality of the book itself. What are your goals long term? And do I have both the capacity and the resources to help you fulfill those goals? And so a whole other things that come into play outside the quality of the book itself. And so I would say that my power to say no, it could be qualified as a scary power. But on the flip side of that, I think you can also point out publishing is such a subjective industry. It truly is. And so as many agents as there are that are going to say no, all you need is one who says, yes, I get it. I can help you get where you want to go. And I want to be along for the ride.
So somewhere in doing my homework, I saw you describe yourself as an adventurous reader.
Mm-hmm.
What tips do you have for the rest of us to be adventurous
readers? I don't know if I have tips. Yeah, I was like, I don't know if I feel qualified to provide advice to other people. But I think in terms of how to be an adventurous reader, I think first and foremost, it comes back to being open to a variety of things. So being open to being surprised, being open to being disappointed, and being okay. Oh my gosh, as someone who's very anal, like has to finish everything, it's been only very recently that I'm like, I'm not going to finish this book and it's okay. I gave it a try. It's very low stakes. They're books. And so if it's something that, you know, ultimately turns out not to be your jam, it's okay. I think the ability to self-eject is pretty easy with books. But I think more specifically, it truly boggles my mind the amount of books that exist. It's almost, it's not infinite. I know that. I know how numbers and math work. It is not infinite. So this kind of endless bounty of different stories that you get to inhabit, why wouldn't you want to do that? Even if it's just for a second and you find out, not for me. Let me move on, right? The endless possibility that is inherent with literature, I don't know if that exists anywhere else. Maybe space. And there's just some, for me, that's so exciting. And I think it spurs that adventurous reading, that ability to explore endlessly and no matter in what context and to fulfill what need, right? Whether it's to be entertained or to find solace or to be affirmed, to be scared, right? The ways that you can come to books and what you get out of them, it's just endless. And I think a real gift.
Oh, fabulous. Those are great tips. Those are great tips. And good reminders, right? Good reminders. Okay. So before I let you go, are you game for my big jar of wannabe analogies?
I am.
Okay. All right. So here we have literal big jar. It's full of slips of paper. I'm going to take out one for you, one for me, one for the audience. We're going to make an analogy to curiosity with whatever is on these slips of paper.
Okay. Oh, your face.
Okay. Yours is teapot. How is curiosity like a teapot? Mine is catapult. And I have one for the audience. So do you want to go first or do you want me to go?
I'll let you go first so I can ruminate on how curiosity is like a teapot.
Okay. A catapult. I actually think catapult's pretty easy in this. You know, curiosity flings you places and will land you in places that then you have to deal with, right? Like we think of the catapult as the propeller, but it also has this net effect that it sends something some other place. And I think curiosity does that. It sends us other places that then we have to deal with. And I think that's a tremendous power. So how is curiosity like a teapot?
I guess you could say curiosity is like a teapot in
thinking of an actual teapot, it, you know, can contain something very nourishing, vitalizing, right? And something that can be, when I think of like tea and tea making, something very like that can be very sacred and like intentional and very personal, right? And of course, like the, you can have like tea parties, but when I, this is how I grew up, when I think of tea, I think of, you know, sitting by yourself, letting, you know, pouring yourself a cup of tea, reading a book or whatever you need to do. There's something inherently relaxing and self-prioritizing about it. And I think curiosity in a certain way, indulgent. Oh, that's where I'm like, I'm going to get there. There's something very indulgent about curiosity. And I mean that in the best possible way of being able to prioritize and center your own fixations and act on them. Yeah, that for me, it kind of imbues the same indulgent kind of self-prioritization of pouring yourself a cup of tea from a teapot.
Oh, that's lovely. I told you before we got started that these analogies often make me think of things differently now. Like now you're my tea thought.
Yes, like indulge.
You're forever with me in my cup of tea. I love that.
Yeah.
And audience, yours is brick. How is curiosity like a brick? Let me know. Social media, hashtag analogy. Well, Kayla, wow, I knew this was going to be fun, but this has just been great. Thank you so much.
This was really fun. And I want to go back and start over.
You've been listening to Choose to Be Curious. I'm your host, Lynn Borton. Thanks so much for joining us here today. You can find all my shows on my website at choosetobecurious.com. I hope you'll follow me here, there, and on social media at Choose to Be Curious, where you can share your brick analogy, hashtag analogy. Many thanks to my guest, Kayla Leitner. Links to her work on my website. Our theme music is by Sean Ballack, and this is Filing Away by Crab Shack via Blue Dot Sessions. I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, choose to be curious.
In terms of like being fearlessly curious as an agent, kind of coming into that curiosity was a journey. It was not something that I started off with. That is only something that I've felt confident and excited about owning in the last 2 to 3 years. But I think when I first started as an agent, there's a particular emphasis on what's your specialty. I certainly understand the need for that, or the desire to have a specialty, that calling card that everybody in the publishing industry knows you for. And so I was kind of floundering trying to figure out what it was for me. And so there was originally embarrassment, if I'm being honest. It felt very jack of all trades, master of none a little bit. Feeling really ashamed of that at first, and it wasn't until recently finally recognizing that, oh, there's actually something very empowering about entering into a space that I don't really know anything about. It's instilled a certain confidence of, oh yeah, this is a job where I really can pivot and do anything.